With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You know, our offense has been about Deshaun ever since he's gotten here, because he's a playmaker and he has the ball in his hand on every snap of offense. And he can dish it to whoever he needs to dish it to. And then when he gets in trouble, he's able to get out of trouble, you know, with his feet and his instincts. So I'm excited that he's gotten 300 yards two games in a row, and hopefully we can keep that rolling and keep him active, because I think he gives us a good chance.
Okay, so at 0-4 a couple weeks ago, the Texans were buried underneath the same rubble as the Giants and the Jets and the Falcons. Three horrific teams to varying degrees. The Falcons finally got a win after they fired their head coach and general manager. Teams that fire their head coach and general manager in season this year are now 2-0 straight up and 2-0 against the spread in the weeks following their firings of those individuals. In the case of the Texans, it was the same person. But 2 weeks ago, Seth, they were 0-4, and there was nothing good going on. There was so little good going on, they felt the need to fire Bill O'Brien. Since then, they're 1-1. They had a chance to beat an undefeated Tennessee team on Sunday. They did not, because the defense has major issues that we'll get to in the next segment. But at the very least, as we're taking baby steps away from 0-4 and away from Bill O'Brien, I think the one thing that we can say is that, okay, well, at least when they lose, they lost in a much more exciting and watchable fashion. So much so that could you make a case that Deshaun Watson right now, not for the body of the season, but over the last few weeks, that he's actually having the best stretch statistically of his career since his rookie year? There's a lot of numbers that would back up. Statistics, we'll talk about the eye test in a second, but statistically at least, he, over weeks 3-6, so going back to the Steeler game, is 7th in the league in completion percentage for that window of time, 1st in the league in touchdown pass percentage, 8.3%, which is near where he was his rookie year, where he was destroying things. 9.5 yards per attempt is a monster, monster number. Passing the football, number one in the league over that time. And number one, not surprisingly, if he's number one in that stat, 34 explosive plays, which was such a huge issue in the first two games of the year against Kansas City and Baltimore. Do those numbers, the numbers that suggest that Deshaun is playing at a very, very high level, do those match what you're seeing on the field right now?
I don't. You know, this is the hard part, Sean. I look at those numbers, and they all make sense. And yet, I don't know if I'm just being a jerk. I haven't felt that way, and I can't quite put my finger on it. I don't know. I'm curious if the listeners agree with me or not. I completely and totally have excuses for him. Like, one of which is the offensive line, which I think has played a lot better than people probably realize in pass protection over these last few weeks. Yet there are breakdowns at key moments that make it almost impossible for Deshaun to do well. I think that until very recently, there were still a lot of miscommunications with the wide receivers. So I don't really put it on Deshaun. I put it more on just him getting comfortable in an offense. But I haven't felt like he's been consistently as good as he was, you know, during some of his better stretches of football.
Yeah.
What am I missing here? Am I just a bastard?
No. Well, I mean, that can be true, and there can be things that are making Deshaun not look. You can be bastard.
I could be a bastard for non-Deshaun reasons.
Right. Let's just keep it focused on Deshaun. I don't think you're being a bastard to Deshaun right now, because here's why. Here's why I think it may not look as good to you as the numbers would suggest it looks. Number one, slow starts. They still have yet to do anything except punt on their first possession of games. Now, at least with Tim Kelly calling the plays exclusively now the last two games, they've managed to at least get a first down as opposed to going three and out, which they did the first four games of the year. They went three and out on their first drive the first four games of the year, but they still have yet to score even a field goal on the first drive of the year. So I think slow starts, number one. Number two, too many three and outs. When they're not driving the field and getting points too often, they're not just the first drive of the game, they're going three and out. And I think it was the Steeler game where, other than the interception that Deshaun threw, they had 10 possessions in that game. They either scored touchdowns on long drives or they went three and out. Literally. That's all they did the entire game, other than the pick that Deshaun threw in that game. So, and I think that's the extreme example, but they've been going three and out way too often this year as well. And I think the other thing, Seth, that I would add to this is that the first two games of the year were such a punch in the face and such a kick to the junk and such a sobering first two games that, you know, realizing, boy, the Texans aren't even close to competing against the best of the best. Forget about beating them. They're not even close to belonging on the same field with the best of the best in the AFC, that it doesn't even matter how Deshaun's playing. If you can't compete with KC and Baltimore, then what's the point?
You know what I feel like this is, Sean? In some respects, I feel like this is a massaging of the advanced stats the way Bill O'Brien or others might want to massage the box score, where in a losing effort where you never really had a chance to win, you say, well, look, hey, we actually ran the ball well, and look at time of possession. We were actually even. That's the old school way of doing it. Now it turns into, well, expected points added, and, well, you know, air yards per attempt and all of that. If it doesn't meet the eyeball test, it's not quite there. And I would go back to, since we're talking about a four-game period, okay, Jacksonville, Tennessee, yeah, I think Deshaun did some really good things in those games. Fine. But Pittsburgh and Minnesota are the first two games of that four-game stretch. In Pittsburgh in the second half, like you mentioned, how good is an offense? The offense is good if it's good when you need it to be good. Mm-hmm. You know, and in Pittsburgh in the second half, the offense was not good at all. Like, not good enough to actually make a push to genuinely win that football game. Minnesota, I would say the same thing. You know, yes, you made a late push to win versus a Minnesota team that, frankly, was criminally lax in how safe they were playing it on defense. But it wasn't all that impressive an effort versus a really bad defense. So I can't take the Minnesota game versus a bad defense, the Jacksonville game versus a bad defense, the Pittsburgh game where I just wasn't impressed with the offense at all, and say, oh, wow, Deshaun's having the best four-game stretch he's ever had.
Yeah, multiple texts from people, I think, bringing up another good point is that two people at least saying it's all the missed passes. Deshaun is good for five or six missed open throws per game. That's a really good point, Seth. It's not that, look, his completion percentage, as we outlined, is nearly 70% over those four games. Good enough for seventh in the league, in a league where completion percentages keep getting higher and higher because that's an efficient way to run football in the short passing game and so forth. 69.7% is what his completion rate is over those four games. That's really good. But I think the texters make a really good point in that when he's missing throws, he's overthrowing open guys. He's been throwing a lot of people's feet this year. Like not really under pressure. You know what I mean?
Kind of hurrying. There's times where he's not under pressure or immediate pressure, and he's hurrying the throw and throwing off of a bad platform. And you know what? That's one of the biggest differences. As much as people love to look at Pat Mahomes' sidearm throws and his circus no-look throws, the thing that makes him really impressive in my eyes is the same thing that made Tom Brady impressive, is the simple stuff. It's the mistakes that you don't make. It's leading on a screen perfectly so that the running back can catch it in full stride and be off to the races. All of those things at times, that feels what is keeping him from being consistent. You know, when you try to play the Chiefs and you say, all right, look, we're just going to play it safe and we're going to let the Chiefs make the mistakes. They don't. They just drive 14 plays right down the field. And especially in the modern NFL, it's easier to do that than it was in the older NFL. So I appreciate Aaron's effort in writing this in the
Aaron
the
Reese
Athletic.
Who wrote the
Aaron
article,
Reese.
Yeah.
But I disagree. I disagree that he's playing the best four-game stretch of football he's ever played.
I do think he's playing better football these last couple weeks. I do think that it feels like a dark cloud has been lifted over him, whether it's a play calling standpoint, whether it's a personality standpoint. Maybe he jives better with Tim Kelly. And I think, Seth, my hope for this offense over certainly this week and maybe through the bye week is that they find a way to be less conventional with, well, we got to establish the run to set up the pass and become more of a team that really establishes Deshaun Watson and then mixes in some David Johnson when it makes sense.
There's times where this offense feels like a woman is telling you, I need it now, take me now. And you're saying, well, hold on a second. I read in a book that I'm supposed to give you 15 minutes of foreplay first and maybe take you out to a nice dinner.
Right.
And she's saying, like, no, give it to me now. Well, shouldn't I first actually like take a shower and get dressed and everything? Come on.
Yeah.
Have some passion in your life. Let Deshaun go at it.
David Johnson is foreplay in this analogy. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Okay. Awkward by the book foreplay.
Yeah.
I'm like, what are you doing? Yeah. Pleasuring you?
Right. David Johnson has been trying to unlatch the bra for six games now. Still not able to unlatch it. All right.
David Johnson is making awkward, poorly landing compliments.
That's right.
Like, wow. You're a lot.
Hey, you know,
I like a lady who's not afraid to look like she's not wearing makeup.
Right. Hey, those jeans look good. You know where else they look good? Rolled up in a ball on the floor of my bedroom.
Yeah.
All right. We talked about the offense. Seth Payne has a plan to fix the Texans' defense. You will hear it next.
Yeah, I mean, our run defense right now is absolutely atrocious, and it's for a variety of reasons. You know, it's guys not doing their jobs. It's winning the battles at the line of scrimmage. It's guys on the second level missing tackles. So we just need to get better at our base fundamental football. There's nothing that they're beating us with schematically. It's about guys defeating blocks, getting off blocks, and then tackling them. And right now we're just not doing that. And that falls on me at the end of the day.
That's Anthony Weaver. That was an interesting quote, Seth, because he said it's nothing we're doing schematically, which says to me that we're in the right formations. You know, we're in the right defensive schemes to combat what the other team is doing. We're just not executing right now. And he does. And that was Anthony Weaver, by the way, the Texans defensive coordinator, and correctly says it's on me because, you know, I'm the defensive coordinator. But I think it's interesting that he sees most of the issues, and I'm curious if you agree with him, that most of the issues right now with the Texans are issues in execution, that they're in position to do things. They're not tackling and executing right now. Do you agree with that assessment? From
well,
what you've seen?
They're not in position to do things. I mean, yeah, the call is okay.
Yeah.
It's but yeah, the players' bodies are out of position because the players are making mistakes.
Yeah.
I would agree with most of that. I mean, there are times where I would go back to two of the notable plays in that game. One was the Wildcat touchdown where Brennan Scarlett just flowed too fast to the front side and just abdicated his responsibilities on the backside. Romeo didn't need to call a timeout. The defense got lined up. I think Bradley Roby actually did a great job of kicking guys out so that the right guys were covered by defensive backs and Brennan Scarlett could play linebacker. And then they just didn't defend it. Everybody on that play defended well except for Brennan Scarlett. That was a physical error. I think on Derrick Henry's huge reception in overtime, Weaver called the blitz, but somebody just let Derrick Henry seep out to the flat uncovered, and there you go. Somebody's got to peel off on him in that instance. So it was a mental error there. I think first and foremost, though, the atrocious run defense is obviously the biggest issue.
Yeah.
Normally, I would say, and maybe this is karma coming back to bite me, normally I would say in the modern NFL, don't worry too much about your run defense. Like the Chiefs. Chiefs have the second worst run defense in the league. Doesn't really matter, right? As long as you got Pat Mahomes on the other side and your pass defense is okay. So I wouldn't worry too much about it unless it's as bad as it is with the Texans. That leads to making it harder for your pass defense. That leads to not being able to help out your secondary as much. It leads to easier passing situations. So fixing the run defense is first and foremost the biggest thing they have to do right now.
All right, so Anthony Weaver says, you know what, I need to bring in Seth Payne as a consultant to help really fix this thing. What are the things that you would do or recommend that Anthony Weaver do to fix this defense?
I think there are at least a couple times in my career where I was on defenses that were really struggling against the run. And I'm guessing Anthony Weaver has already started doing something like this in the last couple of weeks. But it really is as rudimentary as walking through run fits. I saw James Ahedebo tweet this out during the week, and it's completely true. Just actually the walking out the plays and very basically breaking down exactly how everything fits together. Because sometimes the defensive line really doesn't genuinely understand where a linebacker is supposed to fit. You know, he knows his responsibilities, but he doesn't quite get it. And I think likewise, sometimes the linebackers maybe don't give the defensive line enough credit, so they start overcompensating and trying to do more things than they're responsible for. So just very basically breaking it down to those things. And then I also think, too, Sean, I'm not sure these guys are watching film the right way. And I would think particularly amongst the safeties and the linebackers, this is where sometimes not having old veterans and old heads in the building can hurt you. Because a lot of these young guys, even the really good players, they really don't know how to watch film. And I'm watching that game. The recognition on play action was so bad by Terrell Adams and Justin Reed and then especially Zach Cunningham that I don't know if they're watching enough film. I don't know if they're looking for the right keys, but they're like three steps behind on a lot of those plays. So when you're reading pass and Derrick Henry is already at the line of scrimmage, it's a bad, bad deal. So those guys either got to commit to more actual, like, deep film work, and this is where I'm talking about you watch a play, you close your eyes, you visualize yourself responding to that play, you watch it again. Like, it's painstaking, annoying, crappy work, like, actually watching film the right way, and these guys don't look like they're doing it. And I think they, like, sometimes they think they're watching film because they're going through and they're watching and they're, you know, enjoying all the pretty colors and whatnot, but they don't play like they actually, like, you gotta know and feel and understand exactly what's coming.
All right, so that those are a couple of things. Run fits in practice, get better at watching film. What else?
Okay, this would be the other thing. I need to have, like, some old school style. You know, back in the 80s, there were a lot of movies where, hey, the yuppie or preppy white guy goes in to teach inner city youth, and at some point there's always a dance where, or a scene where the kids teach the dorky white guy how to dance.
Or the dorky white chick in Dangerous Minds with Michelle Pfeiffer.
Pfeiffer, did they teach her how to dance?
I think
Julia Stiles at one point was taught how to dance by some inner city kids or something. I think this isn't like a race thing or anything amongst the Texans, but I do feel like the defense in general lacks rhythm when it comes to defending the run game. What do you mean, Seth? What are you talking about? There is a rhythm. There's a rhythm, and Romeo Crennel talked about one of the problems being guys, you know, shedding their blocks or coming off of blocks too early. There's a rhythm in a running play to where, like, as a defensive lineman, it's almost like, okay, lockout, boom, 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 I'm locking out, I throw. And then you throw back, and you make the tackle. These guys are like, they look like Steve Martin in The Jerk, where he's trying to clap along to the music. Remember the day that you and I were both on Zoom and you were trying to clap to the beat of a song, but because of the delay on Zoom, it was like...
We both looked like Navin Johnson trying to...
Yeah. This is what they look like. They look like they've got no feel. They've got no feel or rhythm for when the cutback is coming. And I swear there's a rhythm to a football play. Like, you could set it with a metronome, but you got to kind of... Again, I'll go back to film watching. A lot of it is really, I call it first-person film watching. There's watching film where you say, like, oh, okay, they're lined up in trips here, and okay, there's a near-eye formation or whatever. Like, all these. Then there's first-person film watching where you're actually visualizing yourself in the film, where you're actually visualizing how you're going to play against this. These guys don't play like that's the kind of film watching they're doing. And maybe they are, but they need to do more of it. But that's how you get the rhythm of a run game. That's why Gary Walker and I were so good at stopping the Jaguars early on, Sean, because we had been on scout team versus Fred Taylor for like 3 or 4 years by that point. Tom Coughlin made the veteran players run scout team. So when we got to the Texans, we knew his rhythm. Like, we knew exactly like the rhythm of each one of their running plays, and we were both fantastic dancers. So we shut him down with the love of song and music is how we did it. Mirth. It was a mirthful display. So what we need is, I don't know, who would be the one? I think there was a scene like that in Wildcats, too. I think there was at least one scene where they were teaching the fat white guy how to dance.
Was there one in The Replacements? The Replacements had a touchdown dance where they had everybody dancing, you know, after the winning touchdown.
This is
including
is why,
the big fat Samoan guy. Yeah,
Sean, this is what held us back for about two or three decades on making progress with race relations.
Yeah.
Is because for the entire decade of the 80s, mm-hmm. we acted like, hey, black guys teaching white guys how to dance is enough. That's a coming together of the races. We're cool, right?
Not
it
enough.
Was a whole lot of like, hey, I don't say the N-word. I'm cool, right? Okay, cool. Off we go. So like, let's get back to a little bit of that and just help that stop the run defense.
So there you go. There is Seth Payne's plan to salvage the Texans defense.
And then after that, just honestly, to be very, very serious about this,
yeah.
the play action is going to absolutely destroy this team until the linebackers show that they will not be duped by the play action.
Yeah.
We might see like 50 play action passes this week, unless they show early on that they can stop.
It's no big deal. It's just Aaron Rodgers. It's not no biggie. Jeez. Oh my God. The
that
schedule.
Tampa, by the way, that Tampa defense is for real.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
They were flying around all over the plays. And Ndamukong Suh, I thought at one point at the end of the first half, I got excited. I thought Ndamukong Suh was going to literally rip off Aaron Rodgers' head.
Yeah.
Like, do it right there on the football field like a Pez dispenser.
Yes, and I was like,
that would be the worst, best thing that ever happened to the Texans. I don't even know who the Packers' backup is at this point.
Beautiful. All right, we're going to do some headlines in the next segment. James Click, we've played some of the Jeff Luhnow interview with Vanessa Richardson at Channel 2. James Click, the Astros' actual current general manager, did meet with the media yesterday. Take a listen. Does he give you hope that they'll sign George Springer or fear that they won't? You'll hear from the Astros' general manager next. Sean Pendergast, Seth Payne with you on a Tuesday. Good to be with all of you. James Click met with the media yesterday. He answered the question that I think is at the forefront of everybody's mind now that the season is over for the Astros, and that is, are they going to be able to bring back George Springer? Here is James Click on the challenge of signing George Springer.
First of all, let me just say that you cannot say enough good things about George Springer. He's one of the best players to ever wear an Astros uniform. He's a tremendous human being. He's a tremendous leader in the clubhouse. We wouldn't be doing our jobs if we didn't pursue players like that, whether they were from another organization or from here. But at the same time, we have to contend with the fact that there's just tremendous uncertainty in our industry right now. The industry sustained $2.7 to $3 billion worth of losses, and it may take us years to try to recover from this. So our spending is going to be dependent on what we think 2021 is going to look like operationally and what the market bears out as a result of that. But George Springer, Michael Brantley, it's obvious to everybody how good they are at the game of baseball right now, how much they bring to this team on and off the field. The question is always how do we balance everything and make sure that we put this team in a position to succeed not only in the short term but the long term.
Okay, I don't know. Sound like there was a dog gnawing on his leg at the end of the cut there. But
I thought it was a record scratch, like he was about to like bust out with a rap or something. He was like, "Yo, I'm just joking."
Look at the dance that all the dudes taught me right
then
now.
Then he makes it rain. He's like, "We're signing Springer. We're signing Brantley. We're gonna bring them all back. Hell, you want Reddick? Why not?"
Yeah, I want to get to what he just said, but I think it's a logical follow up here. He was also asked, is Jim Crane going to spend this offseason?
I'm not sure if I would say that his sentiment has changed one way or the other. He obviously wants to supplement this team. He wants to be aggressive where it makes sense, but he also recognizes that we do need to balance the present and the future and make sure that we don't put ourselves in a bad spot in a few years by trying to do too much with it right now.
Seth, I feel like with Jim Crane, we're past the moment of truth with him. And the moment of truth had always been, you know, from 2015, 2016, 2017, the moment of truth was always going to be, okay, when it's time to pay some of these core nucleus guys, is Jim Crane going to step up? Because let's face it, they got to the World Series in 2017 with most of their core still playing under team control, or in the case of Altuve, under a very, very, very reasonable long-term deal that he had signed with a few expensive veterans sprinkled in. The moment of truth was going to be, okay, you're going to pay Altuve. Okay, you're going to pay Bregman. And now he's done both of those things, and he's made big trades for Verlander and Greinke. Like, Jim Crane has answered the bell when it comes to spending the necessary money for the market size that we're in. So I don't feel like Springer leaving would necessarily mean that Jim Crane's not doing his job. I don't know that I feel tremendously optimistic about Springer remaining here after hearing those two cuts from James Klick, though.
Right. You know, it's funny. I think that one thing that people are forgetting with George Springer, if you just look at it from the cold, hard, calculating side of things, is that he's 31 years old right this moment, you know, which means he'll be, I can't remember when his birthday is, he'll be 32.
It was, I think, at the end of September.
Okay, like so yeah, ago, so he'll yeah. Turn, okay, so he's 31 for most of the season, but right. Whatever, he's going to be 32 by the end of next season. Yeah. And that changes the math a little bit. You know, peak for baseball players is 27 years old or so, and then after that, it's all downhill after that. So when you're in a team that's trying to massage the luxury tax as much as possible, and you also have no idea exactly what your finances are going to look like, you've already taken a big hit. You know, baseball has taken like a $2 billion hit so far across all the teams, and you're probably going to take another hit next year. There's at least a really good chance because, I mean, it starts up in less than a half year, and we're not sure how many fans are going to be allowed in the stands, that you might have to say goodbye to George Springer. I think that this is an upside scenario for James Klick. I don't think that anybody can credibly blame him or hold him to the fire if they can't retain George Springer. But if they figure out a way to do it and it doesn't hurt your risk of keeping Correa next year, then I think that he gets a check plus for that. So, or same goes for Brantley. I think that realistically, who's your better? If you take all emotion out of it and all team history and everything else out of it, and it was like for market value, who's the better sign, Brantley or Springer?
I'm glad you asked this because that's exactly where I wanted to go with this. Brantley is not going to cost nearly as much as Springer in the open market. Now, Brantley was playing under a two-year, $32 million deal. I think he as consistent as he is, and he played at an all-star level the 2 years here, he stayed healthy, which was a big thing for Brantley. One of the reasons they got him for 2 years, $32 million, is because he had health issues his last few years in Cleveland. He's been healthy, so maybe that impacts his value. But I feel like with all the things you just talked about and Klick just talked about, Seth, with the pandemic and the drop in revenue, I don't know that it's going to affect Springer's market all that much. He's an elite talent and an October fixture and a guy who would get a fan base really, really excited. Brantley is just a very souped up, consistent, middle of the order hitter. I feel like if you got Brantley for the same amount that you just paid him these last 2 years, but Springer walks, I'm okay with that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, Brantley.
It would suck, don't get me wrong, but I'd be okay with it.
I wish Yuli had been better in the playoffs.
Yes.
Then I could say, hey, they got Yuli on a really good deal.
Yeah.
Yuli's a team-friendly deal still. I mean, you know how playoff droughts go. Sometimes they just happen.
He'll be fine.
He's older, though, so you always worry, is this slump the one that ends up extending out into the future?
Good point.
Even then, it was a reasonable deal. You're not going to get that kind of a break for Springer. And also with Springer's age, I would anticipate there's going to be at least several major league players this year who say, all right, give me a one-year deal because people aren't spending out there. And the teams that you could foresee still spending, like the Dodgers and the Yankees, are kind of all set in a lot of positions. Maybe Springer comes out. Like, how much would you pay Springer on a one-year deal? Would you break the bank or go into the luxury tax for Springer on a one-year deal?
I don't know. I'd have to see how close they're getting to the luxury tax. I think the thing that needs to be pointed out is, hey, Josh Reddick falls off the payroll this year. He was making $13 million. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If Brantley doesn't come back, then all of a sudden there's $30 million that opens up. And oh, by the way, these young pitchers are all under team control and all on really reasonable deals. So maybe there's not the need to go out and spend $10 or $12 million on a veteran arm because Verlander is out for the season, that kind of thing. There's a lot of different dynamics in place. I hate to not give you an answer. If just sight unseen, you go Springer, 1 year, $25 million. Well, hell yeah, let's do it, man. Let's bring the band back together one more year. If he'll come back for one more year, let's do it for another year with George Springer. Absolutely. It's better than doing it without George Springer. Hell yeah, let's go. You know,
they have, it's not like it was this year. I mean, they've got tax space. I always get nervous looking at Spotrac because I don't think – does Over the Cap do baseball yet?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, okay.
OverTheCap.com
is where I go. I migrated over to OverTheCap.com for football.
There's a text message that mentioned, and you mentioned the name Carlos Correa, text message, I think. I think text message cites another dynamic in this thing that maybe 3 or 4 months ago we hadn't necessarily been planning on to this degree. But Carlos Correa's postseason has pushed it to the forefront. It's a legitimate debate. You're not going to be able to keep both of these guys on long-term deals. You've got Bregman on a long-term deal. You got Altuve on a long-term deal. You've still got to put a pitching staff together at some point here. You got to do all the normal spackle and duct tape that comes with putting a major league roster together. Can you survive with a roster if you're Jim Crane, where you're paying Springer $25 million a year for 3 more years after 2021 while trying to compete in the market that Carlos Correa at age 27 is going to generate on the open market if his postseason is something that looks remotely like what his 2021 season is going to look like? The dynamic of Carlos Correa working himself back into the mix as an elite player and someone that Astro fans love is really making this an either-or dynamic with the two of these guys, Seth, more so than it was back at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, no, it did 100%. Boy, it's just so... I feel like our little kids are going off to college, Sean. I feel like all of a sudden you did this three times where all of a sudden your kids grew up and they left the house. I didn't really expect this day to come, and it's I'm getting all verklempt over it.
Well, here's the gamble in the whole thing. Do you let Springer walk without having Correa locked up to any sort of deal? You know what I mean? Because then there's a chance that Carlos Correa right now could be of the frame of mind that I love the Astros, but I want to test out free agency next year, regardless of what happens with Springer. So do you take the bird in the hand? If Springer comes to you and says, look, give me 4 years, $100 million, and that's within your budget, do you sign that? And then knowing that you're going to have to let Carlos Correa walk next year, you're just not going to be able to compete in the Correa market if you've got Bregman, Altuve, and Springer all locked up for 3 or 4 more years at big dollars. And Bregman's deal's not that bad because they bought out his arbitration years. It's like $16 million a year, but there's going to be other expenses. Do you take the bird in the hand with Springer knowing it probably increases your chances of Correa walking, or do you take in some of the analytics that you brought up? I think that you made a great point that Springer's an older player. It would hurt in the short term, but we got to let Springer walk and then take the chance that we can compete in the Carlos Correa sweepstakes.
You know, one thing that I wouldn't over-respond to or overreact to, which I feel a lot of people yesterday did, was James Click got up and said, well, you know, we got to analyze George Springer and we got to figure out and do what's best. He gave all the cliches. I'm okay. Excuse me. That didn't change my optimism or pessimism one bit, and it actually made me feel better about James Click. At least it checked off one box. Did you really want your general manager to get up at the beginning of a negotiation with a player and say, oh, we're going to do whatever it takes to pay George Springer. Desperately can't lose him. Hell no. Of course you don't want to do that, which I fear that sometimes. This is what happens with young football players sometimes that I knew, Sean, myself included. Sometimes you're insecure about like having money for the first time in your life, and you don't drive as hard a bargain as you should, because you haven't yet been screwed over by multiple people.
Right.
And over time, you learn, like, oh, okay, I got to always act like I'm dead-ass broke and stingy as hell, and then maybe people won't try to screw me over as much. So I feel like James Click at least knows that lesson. Not going to get up there and be like, hey, baby, we're fine. Don't worry about the luxury tax. We'll make it work. I got credit. Yeah.
Before we get to headlines, I'm going to tell you right now, we're talking about James Click. That is the only reason that I'm even paying any attention to the World Series this year, is just to see if the Rays can pull it off, because he had such a strong hand in putting that team together. So I just want to learn a little bit more about them in watching this World Series. I learned a lot about them watching them beat the Astros in 7 games, but you brought up this point that the Rays and the way that they're playing and the way that they're going about things should give Astro fans optimism that they've got the dude who was very involved for the last decade and a half in putting that franchise together, that roster together. It's the only reason I'm watching, Seth, because let's face it, this is a World Series that involves the team that beat the Astros in a 7-game series, the team that is the biggest crybaby about the Astros winning the World Series in 2017, playing in that garbage can of a ballpark that they built up in Arlington that looks like some sort of Halliburton briefcase with a brick wall on it. There's no compelling reason other than James Click for me to watch this World Series. Bam. How do you like that?
I like it a lot. Yeah. That's and Charlie Morton. You're not pulling for Charlie Morton?
Maybe. a little bit.
Oh, come on. What's wrong with you? Have you lost your soul?
You got on me last week for saying I have a hard time rooting against Charlie Morton.
Well, that's different. That's different when you're actively trying not to. When he's playing your team, what you do is the same thing you would do if you were wrestling your brother. You detach yourself from your conscience, your memories, your soul, and you go out and do what you need to do. You slaughter people, whether he's your brother or not, until the game is over.
Yeah.
But now the game is over, and you can cheer actively for Charlie Morton again. I hope Charlie Morton has a chance. Let's see. When would he be able to pitch again?
Well, he pitched in game seven on Saturday. So if we're going 4 days rest, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday would be 4 days rest. Well, then they're off on Thursday. So probably this Friday would be his first game.
So this Friday will be game number what for the
game
series?
Number three. It would be game number three.
Yeah. So he'd have a chance of pitching again in game seven, potentially on short rest.
Yes.
So, but one full start where maybe he goes seven shutout innings. That's what I'm hoping for Charlie Morton.
I'll be rooting for him as well, but I just. Seth, I'm not able to just turn my emotions on and off like that. Like you are, like it's a light switch.
Can you root for the demise of the Dodgers one more time in the postseason where they will be reminded that you're not clutch?
Right.
Cody Bellinger had a good thing going. He's had a good playoff for the first time in his career, and then he dislocated his shoulder celebrating a home run.
See, now that's helpful. You putting it that way is helpful. You trying to embarrass me on air because you want me to flip-flop on the Charlie Morton thing is not the way to go about it. You know
it'll test your loyalty to Charlie Morton.
What's that?
Watch him play guitar and sing on YouTube for like three or four times. It's one of those things where the first song, you're like, oh, wow, Charlie Morton's actually pretty good. Then after the second or third time, it's like, oh, this is just some classic D-bag with a guitar trying to get laid. I don't know. I don't need this guy in my life.
He goes from this guy's really good to this guy is okay for a dude who probably just learned guitar by watching YouTube, that kind of thing.
This is this is acoustical guitar guy. Right. I don't need this now.
There you go. Let's do some headlines.
Payne and Pendergast with today's headlines.
All right, the Texans off today. They'll get back at it tomorrow, getting ready for what I would imagine is going to be a very angry Green Bay Packer team that lost to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers 38-10 on Sunday. The Texans, of course, coming off the overtime loss to the Tennessee Titans. Romeo Crennel met with the media yesterday and not really revealing not really revealing anything we didn't already know. They've got to clean up the errors on the defensive side of the ball.
We're trying to figure that out, and we're meeting on that today, and during this week, we'll see if we can come up with a better plan than what we have. Maybe we have to cut back on some of the things that we're doing to keep the mental errors to a minimum, and then the physical part of it. I think we have guys who can play physical football. Sometimes we don't always do it. But so we have to focus on those two areas and see what we can come up with.
Low key, one of the things I really like about Romeo Crennel, he's not afraid to blame the players for a thing or two. O'Brien was always doing that whole, well, it's on me, we got to coach him better, blah, blah, blah. I mean, Romeo takes accountability, but I think he points out that the players are making a bunch of mistakes in this whole thing, too. Seth, let me ask you this. When I hear him talk about simplifying, that was something they were saying 3 weeks ago. We're going to simplify things. How soon until the Texans defense is basically just like the old Tecmo Bowl, where there was run one, run two, pass one, and pass two? How much more can you simplify things?
And line up, and that's the balance you're always trying to find in the NFL is, okay, if you're too complex, then guys make mental errors. If you're too simple, then you're too predictable, and you get just eviscerated. I think that right now, because especially in this last game, play action was such an issue by the safeties and the linebackers, that whatever they were doing that clouded the judgment of those guys, they need to figure that out. And sometimes if you got an either or, you know, like you might have what you think is a simple game plan because there's not a whole lot of total number of plays or packages, but if you're asking guys to make hard decisions or hard judgment calls within a scheme, that's where all of a sudden it gets really complex.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were times where Bill O'Brien thought he was simplifying the offense, but he was still asking the players to do really difficult things mentally in the game. That's where it gets tough. So I think sometimes you can simplify while actually adding more plays, but to take all the thinking out of it, I think maybe that's where Weaver needs to be this week with these guys.
The Green Bay game is the last game before the bye week. Scale of 1 to 10, how badly does this team need a bye week right now? The Texans.
Yeah, I know. I'm just trying to think of that, whether if it's because it's not injury related. Sometimes maybe it's better to just keep going out there and get playing. I don't want to tell them they need a break, so they don't need a. They're too young, Sean. They traded away all their old good players. These young guys, other than JJ, none of them need a break. You need to get out there and get more reps.
Well, Seth, and I know there's going to be 50 texts that come in when I say this, like, Sean, why are you saying this? You're jinxing it. The one thing this team has actually had this year, which makes the 1-5 record even more depressing, is they've had really good luck with injuries so far this year.
Yeah.
They've lost Bernardrick McKinney for the year, but I think Bernardrick McKinney, for a guy who's viewed as one of the better players on the team, certainly one of the more highly paid players, I think he's very replaceable. And the core guys, you know, the guys that I would consider the 8 or 10 most important guys on this team, by and large, they've played every game this year and haven't had to leave games. And especially Will Fuller, who's always been sort of the X factor with this offense, Seth, that they've gotten 6 healthy games out of Will Fuller and they're 1-5, just feel, because we know it's coming. You know what I mean? We know the 4 games that Will Fuller is going to miss, in all likelihood, are coming here, you know?
Well, even if Fuller stays healthy, it's unlikely that the entire wide receiving core will stay healthy. I guess the big thing, and I wish I could remember who pointed this out on Twitter last night. Sean, help me out here. I'm going to apologize to him after the show because I can't think of his name. He used to be Ted Johnson's co-host on the night show here
Fred
at 610.
Fred Davis.
Fred, I apologize a million times. But Fred pointed out, why is it that the Chiefs can lose 2 of their starting offensive linemen and still be absolutely rolling over the Bills, rushing for over 200 yards, like in the first 3 quarters. But with the Texans, all 5 healthy guys can't do this for more than a quarter at a time. It's very frustrating. So you're right. I don't know how they'll withstand or survive an actual health scare. That would be really scary. But it is also part of my... Like, I honestly, sure, everybody could use a bye week or a COVID scare or something that gives them a bye week, but they need reps. The Texans' offensive line has gotten a lot better in pass protection once again. They still have really curious flubs on blitz pickup and protection, but they've done better in pass protection. Some of their run blocking is just absolutely incredibly bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of that stems from not ever having a bread-and-butter run game, like a few several plays that you run over and over again. So these guys never feel comfortable doing anything in the run game. It feels like that's changing from week to week. I think maybe Tim Kelly starts to hang his hat more on this outside zone running game because it helps David Johnson. And maybe we see a little bit less of some of, like, David Johnson getting hit 3 yards in the backfield.
Next headline, Seth mentioned the Kansas City Chiefs, and they win last night. Kansas City 26, Buffalo 17, in the rare but probably becoming more frequent with the COVID Monday Night Football doubleheader. We had a 4:00 kick with Kansas City and Buffalo. We had the regular Monday night game with the Arizona Cardinals just dismantling the Dallas Cowboys 38-10 in the late game in the Monday Night doubleheader. Seth, are the Buffalo Bills now sort of regressing to the mean here? They started out the season 4-0. And I don't want to make excuses for them or make too much of some sort of chain reaction, but ever since they had their game delayed with the Tennessee Titans because the Titans couldn't keep the COVID out of their locker room, they have not looked like the same Buffalo Bills that started out the season 4-0. And Josh Allen is starting to look like the Josh Allen from the playoff game against the Texans last year.
Josh Allen, at the risk of sounding like somebody who's standing for Josh Allen, I will make some excuses for him based on the weather. It looked like an ugly day up there in Buffalo. Yeah. And it looks even worse when there are no fans in the stands, doesn't it? It looks like your crappy JV team where the kids' parents won't even show up because they're so bad.
Right.
And it's an ugly day. This is what Josh Allen's stat line was. 122 yards on 30 attempts.
Yeah. And a lot when the Chiefs were kind of playing prevent also, you know what I mean?
And then you turn it around. And look, the crazy thing, if you didn't get to watch this game at all because you were still at work because it was Tuesday afternoon football, the Chiefs, not a huge rushing team, ran and ran and ran and ran the ball because the Bills said, all right, we're going to drop 8 into coverage and just figure out a way to try to limit Pat Mahomes. As the Texans learned in week 1, you can't do that versus the Chiefs. They are going to absolutely crush you. And this is before They even got their new running back signing, Le'Veon Bell, coming. Who I have a feeling, Le'Veon Bell, who was awful with the Jets, is probably going to turn into vintage Pittsburgh Steelers Le'Veon Bell and be rushing for like 6.5 yards a carry.
Yeah, I feel like there's a better chance Le'Veon Bell sucked because of the environment he was in and not because he's lost a gear, you know?
Frankly, by the way, Clyde Edwards-Helaire, 161 yards. All right, good, I guess. I just watched a guy go for like 250. And if you ain't running for 250.
Derrick Henry's recalibrated everything.
What was Derrick Henry's final? Was it 237?
He had 212 rushing, and he had another 52 receiving. It is emblazoned on my brain.
In overtime.
Yeah.
All the rushing was in regulation, wasn't it? Except for a couple yards in
overtime.
Except
for the Wildcat, yeah. Pretty much. In the late game, the Arizona Cardinals just destroy the Dallas Cowboys, and so much for the whole, Andy Dalton's a capable backup. They should be able to just hum along just fine, the Dallas Cowboys. 34 of 54, 266, two really, really crucial picks thrown by Andy Dalton in that game. Kyler Murray, the box score doesn't look great. He's only 9 of 24 throwing the football, but it was for 188 yards. His 9 completions were for 188 yards. And oh, by the way, Seth, he tacked on another 74 yards on the ground. DeAndre Hopkins, only 2 catches, but they were for 73 yards in that game. Christian Kirk.
With a missed throw, too, where he should have had another one.
Yeah. Christian Kirk, just 2 catches, but they were for 86 yards. So big explosive plays in Cliff Kingsbury's offense for the Arizona Cardinals, who now move to 4-2 on the season. I don't know, how for real do we feel the Arizona Cardinals are, Seth?
I feel like they're playoff for real. Mm-hmm. Like they're KL, now their division is a tough division. San Francisco 49ers problems notwithstanding. But I feel like in a different division, they're a playoff caliber team. But Kyler Murray isn't quite there yet, and his receiving core isn't, it's got big names, but it's not quite what he really needs, I think, as including in his running back and tight end options. The whole picture isn't perfect for him yet, so I still think they're a year away. And Kyler Murray, to his credit, was very tough on himself after the game. He's not just taking his win and acting like he did everything he needed to do. I will say, for anybody feeling really bad about the Texans, you can at least look at the Cowboys' defense and say, wow, they're worse than the Texans' defense. The Cowboys are the worst scoring defense in the NFL. Yes, the Texans might be the worst rushing defense, but the Cowboys are giving up more points than anybody. They are pathetic and weak, and both the Cowboys and the Texans are in danger of being relegated to the Big 12 at the end of the season if they continue to play defense like this.
Maybe the
SEC at this point, because they don't play defense anymore either.
Right, they don't. Nobody does anymore. The one thing the Cowboys can say, Seth, is that they are leading their division at 2-4 right now. They are leading the NFC East right now. Dude, 2-4.
You know what? Baseball fans should stay angry at the NFC East the same way they're angry at the Astros for making the playoffs with a losing record.
Yep. All right, last headline here, and we're going to be joined in a minute here by Vanessa Richardson, who did the interview with Jeff Luhnow for Channel 2 KPRC. Jeff Luhnow did a 37-minute sit-down with Vanessa Richardson and talked about his side of the story with the sign stealing. One of the reveals in the interview that I had not heard before was that Jeff Luhnow approached A.J. Hinch when Major League Baseball warned teams about the Apple Watch scandal with the Red Sox. And when Luhnow went to Hinch to talk about that, A.J. Hinch revealed something we had not heard before.
After the Red Sox and the Yankees were punished in 2017, I had a conversation with our manager, and I asked him if anybody in our dugout was using Fitbits or Apple Watches or anything that would be remotely considered against the rules. He told me that one of our coaches had been using an Apple Watch, but after the incident with the Red Sox, had stopped wearing it because clearly we weren't supposed to be doing that. He did not tell me anything else about trash can banging or any impropriety. I followed up with 2 other people in the baseball operations area, one on the medical side and one of the people that works for me, and made sure that they knew the rules and made sure that we were following the rules.
All right, so that's Jeff Luhnow. The Apple Watch thing is new, Seth. We're hearing that there was an Apple Watch in the Astros dugout. Now, he wasn't clear whether it was being used for nefarious baseball reasons or if it was just being used, I don't know, for steps or something. I have no idea.
We had a guy who was Carlos Beltran was tracking his, using it as a fitness tracker.
There you go.
He said that's all. He said he was, and then he was taking a class in percussion instruments, which was why he was using the trash can.
Yeah.
One thing that I noticed in that interview, I think to Luno's credit, he expressed zero contempt for AJ Hinch. I think he pointed the finger at a lot of people in the organization without naming any names, but I never felt like he was expressly pointing his finger at AJ Hinch, which surprised me a little bit because he was saying that it was, you know, directed by the players and he had no knowledge of it, where I think it's implied, right, that AJ Hinch, obviously, because AJ Hinch has admitted it too, did have knowledge of it.
Said he still talks to AJ Hinch.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there you go.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.